Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the podcast Little Eyes, Little Ears, Centering Children and Youth in Gender-Based Violence Work. This podcast is from the Learning Network at the Center for Research and Education on Violence Against Women and Children at Western University. The purpose of this podcast is to enhance work to support children and youth in contexts of intimate partner violence. I'm Dr. Linda Baker, and I'm pleased to host today's episode with our guest, Tyla Dixon. Tyla, thank you so much for being here with us today. And I wonder if you would just start us off by introducing yourself, telling the audience a little bit about yourself.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Tyla Dixon. Pronouns are they, them. I am the Community Development and Outreach Coordinator for CCWS. I am also a child welfare survivor, which is really how I got into this work. I have been doing advocacy work and legislative work within the family surveillance system, aka the child welfare system. I've worked with the Ministry of Children and Youth. I've worked with formerly the Provincial Child Advocates Office, which is no longer around, unfortunately. I've also worked with several research projects based out of Ryerson University, some grassroots frontline sort of work one-on-one with young people who are also child welfare survivors, as well as some projects that, some projects that looked at care for young people on a global scale, and others more directed at the criminal punishment, the youth criminal punishment system and child welfare or family surveillance. I'm also a tattoo artist. I own a tattoo shop. I co-own a tattoo shop where we heavily integrate these sort of practices of like trauma-informed care, anti-racism. It is one of the few, if not only, walk-in spaces that is primarily Black and Brown artists, as well as like queer and trans folks. So yeah, that's a little side note to the work, but I feel like works well together.
Mm-hmm. Tyla, you mentioned CCWS. Just for the audience, can you explain what that acronym stands for?
Yes, sorry, the Collective Child Welfare Survivors.
And that you were one of the founders or creators of that collective.
Yes, myself, Josh Lamers, and Ashley co-founded the project together.
Okay. Would you describe for our listeners, Tyla, a bit about the connection between the child welfare system and gender-based violence?
Yeah, I think with my work specifically has always been leaned more towards youth centering. It's only within recently with this project with CCWS have we actually been engaging with the parents of children who are being apprehended or put into the system. So it's kind of a new territory for us that we're discovering and navigating through, and really just relying on the people that we're supporting on providing us with like information, with their experiences, and really trying to understand and answer those questions. I know also we focus more within Black and racialized communities. So, I mean, just we were operating a Black mothers and femme parents group that supported specifically Black mothers of families that were being surveilled by the family surveillance system. And a lot of those connections are, you know, a sort of understanding just outside of like child welfare, right? Like we know that Black women are over-surveilled. Black families and Black women are over-surveilled. They're provided with little to no resources. There are stigmas and ideas around Blackness and particularly Black femininity that bleed into the ways in which like these folks can receive services, and not just like specifically racially, but if we think about immigrant families, immigrant parents, and that surveillance, I think, well, it's such a big question, right?
Yes,
to connect.
It really is, but you've really started us off wonderfully, and I'm just, as I listen to that, you're saying that you're centering youth, but have recently started to center youth while really working with their families and especially mothers, it sounds like.
Yes. That is a large portion of, we do individual advocacy. It's part of the services we provide. That's not necessarily my branch. That's not my job. I have taken on some cases here and there. But from what I understand, most of our cases have been mothers. I think maybe we had one father. But that also just speaks to like the sort of inherent misogyny that takes place within family courts, right? Like the idea that women are the best and should be the only primary caregivers, which is so archaic. And it's not to say that like, not speaking directly to the people that we support, but in a lot of situations, regardless, it should never have gotten that far in the first place. It should not have gotten litigious. It should have been, well, I believe there's also an overreporting that's happening with especially like mothers, single parents, immigrant families, immigrant mothers. The jump is to get institutions involved rather than providing resources or building relationships with the families that are a part of the community. So whether that be a lot of reporting happens from like the education system. So their jump is if they see, quote unquote, see something with a child, their jump is to call CAS rather than to engage the parent and try to figure out the sort of resources that could be made available to them. So that's like what we see a lot of. So like even the court to start to discuss the court process, it's like, oh, before we even get there, there's about 15 other things that could have been done before we get there. Right.
Right. Right. And somehow it jumps to or seems to jump to that in sort of worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
When you and just to the extent that you feel comfortable, your own experience, you speak quite openly in podcasts and on panels about your experience within the system and group homes. How does that inform the work that you're doing?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I don't speak much about my experience much these days. I think that how it informs my work has evolved over the years, has changed over the years. Like I said, I started quite young and not really fully understanding the language, not even having graduated high school, was now informing policy, was a part of legislation, like was doing all these things just only understanding it through the lens of my own experience, but also the lens of the community that I was surrounded by, other child welfare survivors. And since navigating those systems on the other side of it, and doing that work and not just being within the system, I realized that we're limited and creating any actual foundational and fundamental change, bureaucracy and all that. And then our own sort of the inherent biases that come along with working within any institution or organization, whether they are meaning to do good or not. There will always be issues of racism, tokenizing, infantilizing, misogyny. So I don't know, like I think like for me now, that experience, it just keeps me grounded in understanding the importance of the work. That's how it helps me. It has given me a resilience, and an empathy and a compassion for this sort of work. But I think that what gets lacking with some folks that engage in this work is that it's no longer my experience anymore. I have not been in care for years. I don't know what it's like to be in a group home now. I don't know what it's like to navigate that system right now. So what is the most important is how I listen and how I absorb the experiences of other folks and do honor to it and center those voices rather than just centering my own experience.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Tyler, I've also heard you use the term critical youth-centering practices. And I think most of us have a sense of youth-centering or feel that we understand what that means. But can you speak a little bit to what do you mean by critical youth-centering practices?
Yeah, so with myself, Ashley or Ash, and Josh, we all kind of come from the we all came from the same background of work. We've actually worked alongside each other on similar projects, not always at the same time, but around that is how we came into relationship to each other. And the idea of critical youth centering is as a response to how we witness these organizations engage in like that sort of work. So although what we appreciated and even protested when the provincial advocate's office, like we shut down Bay and Queen in protest of them shutting down the provincial child advocate's office, they are with a, that comes with a lot of criticism of how the organization functioned, as well as some of the projects that I've worked on. And a lot of what we saw, I'm still catching up, a lot of like what we witnessed and experienced was it was tokenization, it was an infantilizing, there was no capacity building. Like I said, I had even gotten into this stuff, not even graduating high school, at like 15, 16 years old, and not fully understanding the gravity of what it is that we were doing and really understanding the process, right? The only thing I knew is that anything that were to be implemented, I was not going to feel the benefits of. And that wasn't even something that was told to me. That was something that I had to come to realization that I'm fighting for changes to happen within the child welfare system that I will never experience myself. That should have been something that was told to me quite young. There was a lot of requirements from young people to show up in a certain way, to conduct themselves within the lens of respectability. When you're asking marginalized, a heavily marginalized group of people, heavily traumatized group of people to do a work that people have salaries and like 6, 8 years of schooling experience to do, right? So it was truly our lens comes as almost a response to that. So for us, critical youth centering is in a simplified way, it's listening to young people, it's approaching it with humility, also understanding that young people are going to have their own language, are going to engage in ways that are safe and comfortable and real for them. We meet them where they're at. We have to also understand that it's not always a yes to the young person, and it's not always just a no. For us, it's important to, I implement this with even with my own tattooing. It's like informed consent. It is making sure that the person understands all avenues and the gravity of a situation before allowing them to say yes or no to something. So that is what we want to, this is what we do with young people. Another huge part about that is, and I think that sort of becomes a result of doing all the things I mentioned before, is capacity building. Like we cannot function as though we will be in the lives of these young people forever. The support ends, whether it's mandated by an organization or age or just naturally. We have to make sure that we're preparing young people to be without us, and understand the language and understand the system or whatever system they're navigating, that feels natural to them and that could be built upon. I hope that answers your question.
It really does. And it sounds like but correct me if I'm wrong. While you still have concerns, it's not ideal. The work that your collective's done and others, that people are understanding better about how to meaningfully and supportively engage with youth, to center youth without disempowering and without exploiting them, to be quite honest.
I don't know about other organizations. I know I would say I trust more community-based organizations to be doing that sort of work. Ones that are facilitated and ran by young people or the groups of people that are directly affected, right? So I would say that we are doing that in part that we are former, like ch we are child welfare survivors and running this organization, but also in how we engage everybody from the top, like n I wouldn't say top down, but from all aspects of our project down to the volunteers, to myself. There's a level of training that happens. There's a level of capacity building that we do. So everything that we believe in doesn't just translate to the clients or the young people that we support or the families that support. It also happens within within our organization. But yeah, I think when it comes to larger or like institutions or projects that are backed by millions of dollars and at the head of these projects are folks who are on the sunshine list, I wouldn't anticipate that they're doing much of critical youth centering. I don't think that that's the priority. The priority is to have faces of young people on their board so that they could say that they have had young people on their boards. It's a little bit of a
So,
real answer for you, but
no, we want you to be real.
yeah.
Absolutely. So what you're describing is the way you see it is that it's still more perhaps performative than true critical youth centering.
Yeah, I do. I do think so. I think what differentiates us as well is that as much as we can be as individuals, we have a particular kind of politic, right? Like we a politic that is transferable to our personal lives and to the work that we do, no matter what, right? So we are abolitionists by in practice, or we try to be. Obviously we're funded by the government, so that's kind of we understand the limitations of that. But from coming from an abolitionist perspective is also a transformative, right? A transformative perspective, a healing perspective. So we navigate the work that we do through that lens as well, right? Trauma informed, but not just the cute little word of trauma informed, like actually implementing that. Like we, some of us are mad people, or some of us are neurodivergent. So it's like, how do we make the work environment accessible to ourselves and also and like obviously for first and foremost with the people that we serve and we provide for.
You've talked about the importance of building capacity, but also about healing. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about resistance spaces for child and youth survivors of violence.
Yeah. Are you asking if there are spaces that provide that for young people?
Yes, and what those look like.
Right. I think though if I'm being completely honest, this is something that I've been thinking about for a little while for myself. I think the resistance spaces don't actually come from an organization and don't c come from an institution. I think those just come from the community directly. I think it is young people with and marginalized people with shared experiences coming together and providing for each other, whether it's emotional support, you know, a physical support, maybe even sometimes financial, even if the other doesn't have it. It's telling them that they're here and letting them know that they're here and the love is unconditional. And I feel like that comes mostly from the direct community. I don't know if there are a lot of spaces, like structurally that can provide that for young people. I will say that there are some organizations that we are partnered with that are doing that sort of work. But again, like they are people of these communities. But resistant spaces. That and online. I think,
Okay.
I think
Yes.
young people are finding community online and learning, and it's expansive and how they understand themselves and the world. And I think that's where people are connecting, or there's the resistance is coming from.
And that is open to a wider group of young people as well. I mean, it's one thing to be in Toronto area, and it's another thing to be in a more remote location in terms of perhaps finding community in the same way.
Well, if you think of it, like even the conversation around something that we are not necessarily pro-adoption. We're pretty critical of the adoption system. And it's a pretty nuanced and new conversation that is kind of being had. I know somebody that's currently doing the research around that, and even to find resources is so difficult. It's from 20, 30 years ago, and not even really, like, it's kind of trash. It's not done well, and it's almost done to propel interracial adoption, whereas we're now being critical and being like, no to interracial adoption. But I mentioned that to say that, like, the first time I ever really had those conversations were with like folks of in our organization. But then if I'm online, I now follow like several, and we as a page also follow several like individual young people that are having that conversation and sharing their experiences and writing literature and creating content that are talking about this, and educating people. So that's what I say with even online. It kind of gives voice to things that we're like catching up to the young people, right?
Great. And they have that avenue for connecting with others and sharing their experience and their thoughts. Wait, you've talked about so many things that the collective is doing, and I wish we had a lot more time together. But I guess just in terms of your work, in terms of your own personal journey, which you've shared a little bit with us, in terms of the journey, the evolution, in terms of your own perspective, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your hope for the future. In terms of if you look ahead, what would you like to see change in how we support children and youth?
I would like the conversation to be on a larger scale. The issue is that the issue is that people don't understand child welfare, and it is the one institution that literally anybody can have to navigate. Anybody is at risk to either having an interaction with them at any point in time. And it is the largest contributor of criminality, of young criminality, or young people who have been criminalized while within the system and then continued criminalization while they're outside of it, after 18. It's just creating more marginalized individuals in a place where there is limited to no resources, in a world in which is anti-Black, which isn't even, I don't even want to say increasingly, but it's hit the pedal, queerphobic, transphobic, where ableist and unaffordable. And so it's difficult for me to really answer that question, because it's not really a matter of like what can folks working within that sector be doing differently, because any response would be a band-aid solution, which is what we've been doing, trying our best and working against a system that wants us to continue the way that we are. It was built exactly to do what it's doing. So I think it's like, voting is, it's such like a cliche to be like, vote better, or like, be more aware. But I mean that, right? We've created legislation that was passed all the way through, that was doing good work, and within a couple of years and a change of government, it was overturned completely. It's how we lost the Provincial Child Advocate's office. People are just not paying attention. to things outside of themselves, to things that don't directly involve them. In the future, I would like to see, more families supported, better resources, affordable housing, better access to healthcare and mental health, accessible resources for queer and trans children, and people being more aware of their implicit biases, the ways in which they could be anti-Black or anti-Indigenous or racist, because it plays a role in how we interact with each other. It plays a role in how somebody's life is, like, what's going to happen to somebody's life, right? Again, I hope that answered their question.
It absolutely, but you shared many messages, but the one of the fundamental that I think you're stressing for us is we have to stop with the band-aid approach. We're really talking about transformational change, and that doesn't mean tweaking programs here or there. And I think that's one of your fundamental messages.
Totally. You can't just, we talk so much and I get asked that question so much about, like, what do you see for the future? What would you like to see change? And the fact is, we're not going to see change within a system that it was built to operate the way that it is.
Kyla, thank you for sharing this space with us today.
Thank you.
Your ongoing advocacy is truly inspiring. So thank you.
No, thank you.
And for our listeners, please stay tuned for our next episode. And to do that, look out for an email from the Learning Network team, to see when the next episode is ready. Take care and goodbye.